but because her hull was longer. There is such joy in a good ship, and a greater joy to have the ship's belly fat with other men's silver. It is the Viking joy, driving a dragon-headed hull through a wind-driven sea towards a future full of feasts and laughter. The Danes taught me that, and I love them for it, pagan swine though they might be. At that moment, running before Svein's white horse, I was as happy as a man could be, free of all the churchmen and laws and duties of Alfred's Wessex. But then I gave orders that the sail was to be lowered, and a dozen men uncleated the lines and the big yard scraped down the mast. We had come to Britain's ending, and I would turn about, and I waved to Svein as the white horse swept past us. He waved back, watching the Firedrakker wallow in the long ocean swells. "Seen enough?" Leofric asked me. I was staring at the end of Britain, where the rocks endured the sea's assault.
"Penwith,"
Isolt said, giving me the British name for the headland. "You want to go home?" I asked Leofric. He shrugged. The crew was turning the yard, lining it fore and aft, so it could be stowed on its crutches, while other men were binding the sail so it did not flap. The oars were being ready to take us eastwards, and the white horse was getting smaller as it swept up into the Severn Sea. I stared after Svein, envying him. "I need to be rich," I said to Leofric. He laughed at that. "I have a path to follow," I said, "and it goes north. North back to Bebbanburg. And Bebbanburg has never been captured, so I need many men to take it. Many good men, and many sharp swords."
"Oh, we have silver," he said, gesturing into the boat's bilge.
"Not enough," I answered sourly. My enemies had money, and Alfred claimed that I owed the church money, and the courts of Devonshire would be chasing me for Weargild. I could only go home if I had enough silver to pay off the church, to bribe the courts, and to attract men to my banner. I stared at the white horse, which was now little more than a sail above the wind-fretted sea, and I felt the old temptation to go with the Danes. Wait till Ragnar was free, and give him my sword-arm. But then I would be fighting against Leofric, and I would still need to make money, raise men, go north, and fight for my birthright. I touched Thor's hammer, and prayed for a sign. Isolt spat. That was not quite true. She said a word which sounded like someone clearing their throat, spitting and choking all at the same time. And she was pointing over the ship's side, and I saw a strange fish arching out of the water. The fish was as big as a deerhound, and had a triangular fin.
"Porpoise," Leofric said.
"Clam hiddeth,"
Isolt said again, giving the fish its British name. "They bring sailors luck," Leofric said. I'd never seen a porpoise before, but suddenly there were a dozen of the creatures. They were grey, and their backs glistened in the sun, and they were all going north. "Put the sail back up," I told Leofric. He stared at me. The crew was unlashing the oars and taking the plugs from the oar holes.
"You want the sail up?" Leofric asked.
"We're going north." I had prayed for a sign, and Thor had sent me the porpoise.
"There is nothing in the Severn Sea," Leofric said. "Svein told you that."
"Svein told me there was no plunder in the Severn Sea," I said, "because the Danes have taken it all. So that means the Danes have the plunder." I felt a surge of happiness so intense that I punched Leofric's shoulder and gave Isolt a hug. "And he told me that their ships are coming from Ireland."
"So?"
Leofric rubbed his shoulder. "Men! From Ireland," I told Leofric. "Danes coming from Ireland to attack Wessex. And if you brought a ship's crew from Ireland, what would you bring with you?"
"Everything you possess," Leofric said flatly. and they don't know we're here. They're sheep, and we are a fire dragon.
He grinned.
You're right, he said. Of course I'm right. I'm a lord. I'm right, and I'm going to be rich. We're all going to be rich. We shall eat off gold plates, piss down our enemies' throats, and make their wives into our whores.
Yeah, I was shouting this nonsense as I walked down the boat's centre, casting off the sail's lashings.
We'll all be rich, with silver shoes and golden bonnets. We'll be richer than kings. We'll wallow in silver, shower our whores with gold and shit lumps of amber. Tie those oars up, plug the holes, we're going north. We're going to be rich as bishops, every man of us.
The men were grinning, pleased because I was roaring my enthusiasm, and men like to be led. They did have qualms about going north, for that would take us out of sight of land, and I'd never been that far from the shore. And I was frightened too, for Ragnar the Elder had often told me tales of Norsemen who had been tempted out into the sea wastes to sail ever farther westwards, and he said there were lands out there, lands beyond the Isles of the Dead, lands where ghosts walked. But I'm not sure if he told the truth. I am sure, though, that he told me that many of those ships never returned. They voyage into the dying sun, and they go onwards because they cannot bear to turn back. And so they sail to where the lost ships die, at the world's dark ending. Yet the world did not end to the north. I knew that, though I was not certain what did lie northwards. Difford was there somewhere, and Ireland. And there were other places with barbarous names and savage people who lived like hungry dogs on the wild edges of the land. But there was also a waste of sea, a wilderness of empty waves. And so, once the sail was hoisted and the wind was thrusting the fire draken northwards, I leaned on the oar to take her somewhat to the east, for fear we would otherwise be lost in the ocean's vastness.
"You know where you're going?" Leofric asked me.
No.
You care?
I grinned at him for answer. The wind, which had been southerly, came more from the west, and the tide took us eastwards, so that by the afternoon I could see land, and I thought it must be the land of the Britons on the north side of the Severn. But as we came closer, I saw it was an island. I later discovered it was the place the Northmen call Lundi, because that's their word for the puffin, and the island's high cliffs were thick with the birds, which shrieked at us when we came into a cove on the western side of the island. It was an uncomfortable place to anchor for the night, because the big seas rolled in, and so we dropped the sail, took out the oars, and rowed around the cliffs until we found shelter on the eastern side. I went ashore with Isolt, and we dug some puffin burrows to find eggs. They all were hatched, so we contented ourselves with killing a pair of goats for the evening meal. There was no one living on the island, though there had been because there were the remains of a small church and a field of graves. The Danes had burned everything, pulled down the church and dug up the graves in search of gold. We climbed to a high place, and I searched the evening sea for ships, but saw none. Though I wondered if I could see land to the south. It was hard to be sure, for the southern horizon was thick with dark cloud. But a darker strip within the cloud could have been hills, and I assumed I was looking at Cornwallum, or the western part of Wessex. Isolt sang to herself. I watched her. She was gutting one of the dead goats, doing it clumsily, for she was not accustomed to such work. She was thin, so thin that she looked like the elf sin, the elf kind. But she was happy. In time I would learn just how much she had hated Peridot. He had valued her and made her a queen, but he had also kept her a prisoner in his hall, so that he alone could profit from her powers. Folk would pay Peridot to hear Isolt's prophecies, and one of the reasons Callin had fought his neighbour was to take Isolt for himself.
Shadow queens were valued among the Britons, for they were part of the old mysteries, the powers that had brooded over the land before the monks arrived, and Isolde was one of the last Shadow Queens. She had been born in the sun's darkness, but now she was free, and I was to find she had a soul as wild as a falcon. Mildred, poor Mildred, wanted order and routine. She wanted the hall swept, the clothes clean, the cows milked, the sun to rise, the sun to set, and for nothing to change. But Isolde was different. She was strange, shadow-born and full of mystery. Nothing she said to me those first days made any sense, for we had no language in common. But on the island, as the sun set, and I took the knife to finish cutting the entrails from the goat, she plucked twigs and wove a small cage. She showed me the cage, broke it, and then, with her long white fingers, mimed a bird flying free. She pointed to herself, tossed the twig scraps away, and laughed. Next morning, still ashore, I saw boats. There were two of them, and they were sailing to the west of the island, going northwards. They were small craft, probably traders from Cornwallum, and they were running before the southwest wind towards the hidden shore where I assumed Svein had taken the white horse. We followed the two small ships. By the time we had waded out to Firedracker, raised her anchor and rowed her from the lee of the island, both boats were almost out of sight. But once our sail was hoisted, we began to overhaul them. They must have been terrified to see a dragon ship shoot out from behind the island. But I lowered the sail a little to slow us down, and so followed them for much of the day, until at last a blue-grey line showed at the sea's edge. Land. We hoisted the sail fully, and seethed past the two small tubby boats, and so, for the first time, I came to the shore of Wales. The Britons had another name for it, but we simply called it Wales, which means foreigners. And, much later, I worked out that we must have made that landfall in Dyfed, which is the name of the churchman who converted the Britons of Wales to Christianity, and had the westernmost kingdom of the Welsh named for him. We found a deep inlet for shelter. Rocks guarded the entrance, but once inside we were safe from wind and sea. We turned the ship so that her bows faced the open sea, and the cove was so narrow that our stern scraped stone as we slewed Firedracker about. And then we slept on board. Men and their women sprawled under the rowers' benches. There were a dozen women aboard, all captured from Peredur's tribe, and one of them managed to escape that night, presumably sliding over the side and swimming to shore. It was not Isolde. She and I slept in the small black space beneath the steering platform, a hole screened by a cloak. And Leofric woke me there in the dawn, worried that the missing woman would raise the country against us. I shrugged. We won't be here long. But we stayed in the cove all day. I wanted to ambush ships coming around the coast, and we saw two. But they travelled together, and I could not attack more than one ship at a time. Both ships were under sail, riding the southwest wind, and both were Danish, or perhaps Norse, and both were laden with warriors. They must have come from Ireland, or perhaps from the east coast of Northumbria, and doubtless they travelled to join Svein, lured by the prospect of capturing good West Saxon land. Bergweird should have the whole fleet up here, I said. He could tear through these bastards. Two horsemen came to look at us in the afternoon. One had a glinting chain about his neck, suggesting he was of high rank, but neither man came down to the shingle beach. They watched from the head of the small valley that fell to the cove, and after a while they went away. The sun was low now, but it was summer, so the days were long. "If they bring men," Leofric said as the two horsemen rode away. But he did not finish the thought. I looked up at the high bluffs on either side of the cove. Men could rain rocks down from those heights, and the fire dracker would be crushed like an egg. We could put sentries up there, I suggested. But just then, Edric, who led the men who occupied the forward starboard benches, shouted that there was a ship in sight. I ran forward, and there she was, the perfect prey. She was a large ship, but not so big as Firedracker, but large all the same, and she was riding low in the water, for she was so heavily laden. Indeed, she carried so many people that her crew had not dared raise the sail, for, though the wind was not heavy, it would have bent her leeward side dangerously close to the water. She was being rowed, and now she was close inshore, evidently looking for a place where she could spend the night, and her crew had plainly been tempted by our cove, and only now realized that we already filled it. I could see a man in her bows pointing further up the coast, and meanwhile my men were arming themselves. And I shouted at Hasten to take the steering oar. He knew what to do, and I was confident he would do it well, even though it might mean the death of fellow Danes. We cut the lines that had tethered us to the shore, as Leofric brought me my mail coat, helmet and shield. I dressed for battle as the oars were shipped, then pulled on my helmet so that suddenly the edges of my vision were darkened by its faceplate. "Go!" I shouted. And the oars bit, and the Firedracker surged out. Some of the oar blades struck rock as we pulled, but none broke. And I was staring at the ship ahead, so close now, and her prow was a snarling wolf, and I could see men and women staring at us, not believing what they saw. They thought they saw a Danish ship, one of their own, yet we were armed and we were coming for them. A man shouted a warning, and they scrambled for their weapons, and Leofric yelled at our men to put their hearts into the oars, and the long shafts bent under the strain, as Firedracker leapt across the small waves, and I yelled at the men to leave the oars, to come to the bows, and Kenwulf and the 12 men he commanded were already there, as our big bows slammed through the enemy oars, snapping them. Hasten had done well. I told him to steer for the forward part of the ship, where her freeboard was low, and our bows rowed up across her strakes, plunging her low in the water, and we staggered with the impact. But then I jumped down into the wolf-headed ship's belly. Kenwulf and his men were behind me, and there we began the killing. The enemy ship was so loaded with men that they probably outnumbered us, but they were bone-weary from a long day's rowing. They'd not expected an attack, and we were hungry for wealth. We had done this before, and the crew was well trained. And they chopped their way down the boat, swords and axes swinging, and the sea was slopping over the side so that we waded through water as we clambered over the rowers' benches. The water about our feet grew red. Some of our victims jumped overboard and clung to shattered oars in an attempt to escape us. One man, big-bearded and wild-eyed, came at us with a great sword, and Edric drove a spear into his chest, and Leofric struck the man's head with his axe, struck again, and blood sprayed up to the sail that was furled fore and aft on its long yard. The man sank to his knees, and Edric ground the spear deeper so that blood spilled down to the water. I almost fell as a wave tilted the half-swamp ship. A man screamed and lunged a spear at me. I took it on my shield, knocked it aside, and rammed serpent breath at his face. He half fell, trying to escape the lunge, and I knocked him over the side with my shield's heavy boss. I sensed movement to my right, and swung serpent breath like a reaping scythe and struck a woman in the head. She went down like a felled calf, a sword in her hand. I kicked the sword away and stamped on the woman's belly. A child screamed, and I shoved her aside, lunged at a man in a leather jerkin, raised my shield to block his axe blow, and then spitted him on serpent breath. The sword went deep into his belly, so deep that the blade stuck, and I had to stand on him to tug it free. Kenwulf went past me, his snarling face covered in blood, sword swinging. The water was up to my knees, and then I staggered and almost fell as the whole ship lurched, and I realized we had drifted ashore and struck rocks. Two horses were tethered in the ship's belly, and the beast screamed at the smell of blood. One broke its tether and jumped overboard, swimming white-eyed towards the open sea. "Kill them! Kill them!" I heard myself shouting. It was the only way to take a ship, to empty her of fighting men. But she was now emptying herself, as the survivors jumped onto the rocks and clambered away through the sucking backwash of blood-touched water. A half-dozen men had been left aboard Firedracker, and they were fending her off the rocks with oars. A blade stabbed the back of my right ankle, and I turned to see a wounded man trying to hamstring me with a short knife, and I stabbed down again and again, butchering him in the weltering water. And I think he was the last man to die on board, though a few Danes were still clinging to the ship's side, and those we cut away. The Firedracker was seaward of the doomed ship now, and I shouted at the men aboard to bring her close. She heaved up and down, much higher than the half-sunk ship, and we threw our plunder up and over the side. There were sacks, boxes and barrels. Many were heavy, and some clinked with coin. We stripped the enemy dead of their valuables, taking 6 coats of mail and 12 helmets, and we found another 3 coats of mail in the flooded bilge. I took 8 arm rings off dead men. We tossed weapons aboard Firedracker, then cut away the captured ship's rigging. I loosed the remaining horse that stood shivering as the water rose. We took the ship's yard and sail, and all the time our survivors watched from the shore, where some had found a precarious refuge above the sea-washed rocks. I went to the space beneath her sleeping platform, and found a great war helm there. A beautiful thing, with a decorated faceplate and a wolf's head moulded in silver on the crown. And I tossed my old helmet onto Firedracker and donned the new one, and then passed out sacks of coin. Beneath the sacks was what I thought must be a small shield wrapped in black cloth, and I half thought of leaving it where it was, then threw it into Firedracker anyway. We were rich.
"Who are you?"
a man shouted from on shore.
"Uhtred!"
I called back. He spat at me, and I laughed. Our men were climbing back on board Firedracker now. Some were retrieving oars from the water, and Leofric was pushing Firedracker away, fearful that she would be caught on the rocks.
"Get on board!"
he shouted at me. And I saw I was the last man, and so I took hold of Firedracker's stern, put a foot on an oar, and heaved myself over her side.
"Row!"
Leofric shouted. And so we pulled away from the wreck. 2 young women had been thrown up with the plunder, and I found them weeping by Firedracker's mast. One spoke no language that I recognized, and later we discovered she was from Ireland. But the other was Danish. And as soon as I squatted beside her, she lashed out at me and spat in my face. I slapped her back, and that made her lash out again. She was a tall girl, strong, with a tangled mass of fair hair and bright blue eyes. She tried to claw her fingers through the eye holes of my new helmet, and I had to slap her again, which made my men laugh. Some were shouting at her to keep fighting me, but instead, she suddenly burst into tears and leaned back against the mast root. I took off the helmet and asked her name, and her only answer was to wail that she wanted to die. But when I said she was free to throw herself off the ship, she did not move. Her name was Freya. She was 15 years old, and her father had been the owner of the ship we had sunk. He had been the big man with the sword, and his name had been Ivar, and he had held land in Dyflin, wherever that was, and Freya began to weep again when she looked at my new helmet, which had belonged to her father.
"He died without cutting his nails,"
she said accusingly, as if I were responsible for that ill look. And it was bad fortune indeed, because now the grim things of the underworld would use Ivar's nails to build the ship that would bring chaos at the world's end. "Where were you going?" I asked her. To Svein, of course. Ivar had been unhappy in Dyflin, which was in Ireland, and had more Norsemen than Danes, and also possessed savagely unfriendly native tribes. And he had been lured by the prospect of land in Wessex. and so he had abandoned his Irish steading, put all his goods and wealth aboard his ships, and sailed eastwards. "Ships?" I asked her.
"There were three when we left,"
Freya said.
"But we lost the others in the night."
I guessed they were the two ships we'd seen earlier. But the gods had been good to me, for Freya confirmed that her father had put his most valuable possessions into his own ship, and that was the one we had captured. And we had struck lucky, for there were barrels of coin and boxes of silver. There was amber, jet, and ivory. There were weapons and armour. We made a rough count as the Firedrakker wallowed offshore, and we could scarce believe our fortune. One box contained small lumps of gold, roughly shaped as bricks. But best of all was the wrapped bundle, which I had thought was a small shield, but which, when we unwrapped the cloth, proved to be a great silver plate, on which was modelled a crucifixion. All about the death scene, ringing the plate's heavy rim, were saints, 12 of them. I assume they were the apostles, and that the plate had been the treasure of some Irish church or monastery before Ivar had captured it. I showed the plate to my men. "This," I said reverently, "is not part of the plunder. This must go back to the church." Leofric caught my eye, but did not laugh. "It goes back to the church," I said again. And some of my men, the more pious ones, muttered that I was doing the right thing. I wrapped the plate and put it under the steering platform.
"How much is your debt to the church?" Leofric asked me.
"You have a mind like a goat's arsehole," I told him. He laughed, then looked past me.
"Now, what do we do?" he asked. I thought he was asking what we should do with the rest of our charmed lives, but instead he was gazing at the shore, where, in the evening light, I could see armed men lining the clifftop. The Britons of Difford had come for us, but too late. Yet their presence meant we could not go back into our cove, and so I ordered the oars to be manned, and for the ship to row eastwards. The Britons followed us along the shore. The woman who had escaped in the night must have told them we were Saxons, and they must have been praying we would seek refuge on land so they could kill us. Few ships stayed at sea overnight, not unless they were forced to. But I dared not seek shelter, and so I turned south and rowed away from the shore, while in the west the sun leaked red fire through rifts in the cloud, so that the whole sky glowed, as if a god had bled across the heavens.
"What will you do with the girl?"
Leofric asked me.
"Freya?
Is that her name? You want her?"
"No,"
I said.
"I do."
"She'll eat you alive," I warned him. She was probably a head taller than Leofric.
"I like them like that,"
he said.
"All yours,"
I said. "And such is life.
One day Freya was the pampered daughter of an earl, and the next she was a slave." I gave the coats of mail to those who deserved them. We had lost 2 men, and another 3 were badly injured. But that was a light cost. We had, after all, killed 20 or 30 Danes, and the survivors were ashore where the Britons might or might not treat them well. Best of all, we had become rich, and that knowledge was a consolation as night fell. Hodder is the god of the night, and I prayed to him. I threw me old helmet overboard as a gift to him, because all of us were scared of the dark that swallowed us. And it was a complete dark, because clouds had come from the west to smother the sky. No moon, nor stars. For a time there was the gleam of firelight on the northern shore, but that vanished, and we were blind. The wind rose, the seas heaved us, and we brought the oars inboard and let the air and water carry us, for we could neither see nor steer. I stayed on deck, peering into the dark, and Isult stayed with me under my cloak, and I remembered the look of delight on her face when we had gone into battle. Dawn was grey, and the sea was white-streaked grey, and the wind was cold. Then there was no land in sight. But two white birds flew over us, and I took them for a sign, and rowed in the direction they had gone. And late that day, in a bitter sea and cold rain, we saw land, and it was the Isle of Puffins again, where we found shelter in the cove and made fires ashore.
"When the Danes know what we've done," Leofric said,
"they'll look for us." I finished the sentence for him.
"Lots of them will look for us."
"And then it's time to go home," I said. The gods had been good to us, and next dawn, in a calming sea, we rowed south to the land and followed the coast towards the west. We would go around the wild headlands where the porpoises swam, turn east, and so find home. Much later, I discovered what Svein had done after we parted company, and because what he did affected my life and made the enmity between me and Alfred worse, I shall tell it here. I suspect that the thought of a gold altar at Sinuit had gnawed into his heart, for he carried the dream back to Glwysing, where his men gathered. Glwysing was another kingdom of the Britons in the south of Wales, a place where there were good harbours and where the king welcomed the Danes, for their presence prevented Guthrum's men from raiding across the Mercian border. Svein ordered a second ship and its crew to accompany him, and together they attacked Sinuit. They came in the dawn, hidden by a mist, and I can imagine their beast-headed ships appearing in the early greyness like monsters from a nightmare. They went upriver, oars splashing, then grounded the boats and the crews streamed ashore, men in mail and helmets, spear-Danes, sword-Danes, and they found the half-built church and monastery. Odda the Younger was making the place, but he knew it was too close to the sea, and so he had decided to make it a fortified building. The church's tower was to be of stone, and high enough for men to keep a watch from its summit, and the priests and monks were to be surrounded by a palisade and a flooded ditch. But when Svein came ashore, none of the work was finished, and so it was indefensible. And besides, there were scarce 40 troops there, and those all died or fled within minutes of the Danes' landing. The Danes then burned what work had been done, and cut down the high wooden cross which customarily marked a monastery, and which had been the first thing the builders had made. The builders were monks, many of them novices, and Svein herded them together and demanded they show him where the valuables were hidden, and promised them mercy if they told the truth, which they did. There was not much of value, certainly no altar of gold, but supplies and timber needed to be purchased, and so the monks had a chest of silver pennies, which was reward enough for the Danes, who then pulled down the half-constructed church tower, wrecked the unfinished palisade, and slaughtered some cattle. Then Svein asked the monks where Uber was buried, and was met by sullen silence. And the swords were drawn again, and the question asked a second time, and the monks were forced to confess that the church was being built directly over the dead chieftain's grave. That grave had been an earth mound, but the monks had dug it up and thrown the body into the river, and when the Danes heard that story, the mercy fled from their souls. The monks were made to wade in the river until some bones were found, and those bones were placed on a funeral pyre made from the timbers of the half-constructed buildings. It was, by all accounts, a huge pyre, and when it was lit, and when the bones were at the heart of a furnace blaze, the monks were thrown onto the flames. While their bodies burned, the Danes selected two girls, captured from the soldiers' shelters, raped them, and then strangled them, sending their souls to be company for Uber in Valhalla. We heard all this from two children who survived by hiding in a nettle patch, and some folk from the nearby town who were dragged to see the end of the funeral pyre.
Svein of the White Horse did this, they were told, and made to repeat the words. It was a Danish custom to leave some witnesses to their horror, so that the tales would spread fear and make cowards of other folk who might be attacked. And sure enough, the story of the burned monks and murdered girls went through Wessex like a high wind through dry grass. It became exaggerated, as such tales do. The number of dead monks went from 16 to 60, the raped girls from 2 to 20, and the stolen silver from a chest of pennies to a hoard worthy of the gods. Alfred sent a message to Guthrum demanding to know why he should not slaughter the hostages he held, and Guthrum sent him a present of gold, 2 captured gospel books, and a grovelling letter in which he claimed that the 2 ships had not been from his forces, but were pirates from beyond the sea. Alfred believed him, and so the hostages lived, and the peace prevailed. But Alfred commanded that a curse should be pronounced on Svein in every church of Wessex. The Danish chieftain was to be damned through all eternity. His men were to burn in the fires of hell, and his children, and his children's children, were all to bear the mark of Cain. I asked a priest what the mark was, and he explained that Cain was the son of Adam and Eve, and the first murderer. But he did not know what mark he had carried. He thought God would recognize it. So Svein's 2 ships sailed away, leaving a pillar of smoke on the Wessex shore, and I knew none of it. In time I would know all of it, but for now I was going home. We went slowly, sheltering each night, retracing our steps that took us past the blackened hillside where Peredur's settlement had stood, and on we went, under a summer's sun and rain, until we had returned to the Usk. The Heingal was afloat now, and her mast was stepped, which meant Leofric could take her and the Eftweird, for the Firedracker was no more, back to Hampton. We divided the plunder first, and though Leofric and I took the greater share, every man went away wealthy. I was left with Hasten and Isolt, and I took them up to Oxton, where Mildreth wept with relief because she had thought I might be dead. I told her we had been patrolling the coast, which was true enough, and that we had captured a Danish ship laden with wealth, and I spilled the coins and gold bricks onto the floor and gave her a bracelet of amber and a necklace of jet, and the gifts distracted her from Isolt, who watched her with wide dark eyes. And if Mildreth saw the British girl's jewellery, she said nothing. We had come back in time for the harvest, though it was poor, for there had been much rain that summer. There was a black growth on the rye, which meant it could not even be fed to the animals, though the straw was good enough to thatch the hall I built. I've always enjoyed building. I made the hall from clay, gravel, and straw, all packed together to make thick walls. Oak beams straddled the walls, and oak rafters held a high, long roof that looked golden when the thatch was first combed into place. The walls were painted with powdered lime in water, and one of the local men poured ox blood into the mix so that the walls were the colour of a summer sky at sunset. The hall's great door faced east towards the Usk, and I paid a man from Exoncester to carve the doorposts and lintels with writhing wolves, for the banner of Bebbanburg, my banner, is a wolf's head. Mildreth wanted the carving to show saints, but she got wolves. I paid the builders well, and when other men heard that I had silver, they came looking for employment. And though they were there to build my hall, I took only those who had experience of fighting. I equipped them with spades, axes, adzes, weapons, and shields.
"You are making an army,"
Mildreth accused me. Her relief at my homecoming had soured quickly when it was apparent that I was no more a Christian than when I had left her. 17 men? An army?
"We are at peace," she said.
She believed that because the priests preached it. And the priests only said what they were told to say by the bishops, and the bishops took their orders from Alfred. A travelling priest sought shelter with us one night, and he insisted that the war with the Danes was over. "We still have Danes on the border," I said. "God has calmed their hearts," the priest insisted, and told me that God had killed the Lothbrok brothers, Uber, Ivar, and Halfdan, and that the rest of the Danes were so shocked by the deaths that they no longer dared to fight against Christians. "It is true, Lord," the priest said earnestly. "I heard it preached in Sippenham, and the king was there, and he praised God for the truth of it. We are to beat our swords into ard points, and our spear blades into reaping hooks." I laughed at the thought of melting serpent breath into a tool to plough Oxton's fields. But then, I didn't believe the priest's nonsense. The Danes were biding their time, that was all. Yet it did seem peaceful as the summer slid imperceptibly into autumn. No enemies crossed the frontier of Wessex, and no ships harried our coasts. We threshed the corn, netted partridges, hunted deer on the hill, staked nets in the river, and practiced with our weapons. The women span thread, gathered nuts, and picked mushrooms and blackberries. There were apples and pears, for this was the time of plenty, the time when the livestock was fattened before the winter slaughter. We ate like kings, and, when my haul was finished, I gave a feast, and Mildred saw the ox head over the door, and knew it was an offering to Thor, but said nothing. Mildred hated Isolde, which was hardly surprising, for I told Mildred that Isolde was a queen of the Britons, and that I held her for the ransom that the Britons would offer. I knew no such ransom would ever come, but the story went some way to explaining Isolde's presence. But Mildred resented that the British girl was given her own house. "She is a queen," I said.
"You take her hunting,"
Mildred said resentfully. Well, I did more than that, but Mildred chose to be blind to much of it. Mildred wanted little more than her church, her baby, and an unvarying routine. She had charge of the women who milked the cows, churned the butter, span wool, and collected honey, and she took immense pride that those things were done well. If a neighbour visited, there would be a flurry of panic as the hall was cleaned, and she worried much about those neighbours' opinions. She wanted me to pay Oswald's weregild. It did not matter to Mildred that the man had been caught thieving, because to pay the weregild would make peace in the valley of the Usk. She even wanted me to visit Odda the Younger.
"You could be friends,"
she pleaded. "With that snake?"
"And Werken says you have not paid the tithe."
Werken was the priest in Exonminster, and I hated him. "He eats and drinks the tithe," I snarled. The tithe was the payment all landholders were supposed to make to the church, and by rights I should have sent Werken part of my harvest. But I had not. Yet the priest was often at Oxton, coming when he thought I was hunting, and he ate my food and drank my ale and was growing fat on them.
"He comes to pray with us,"
Mildred said. "He comes to eat," I said.
"And he says the bishop will take the land if we don't pay the debt."
"The debt will be paid," I said.
"When?" "We have the money."
She gestured at the new hall.
"When?"
she insisted. "When I want to," I snarled. I did not tell her when or how, because if I had, then Werken the priest would know, and the bishop would know. It was not enough to pay the debt. Mildred's father had foolishly donated part of our land's future produce to the church, and I wanted that burden taken away so the debts would not go on through eternity. And to do that, I needed to surprise the bishop. And so I kept Mildred ignorant. And inevitably, those arguments would end with her tears. I was bored with her, and she knew it. I found her beating Isolde's maid one day. The girl was a Saxon I'd given to Isolde as a servant, But she also worked in the dairy, and Mildreth was beating her because some cheeses had not been turned. I dragged Mildreth away, and that, of course, provoked another argument, and Mildreth proved not to be so blind after all, for she accused me of trying to whelp bastards on Isolt, which was true enough. But I reminded her that her own father had sired enough bastards, half a dozen of whom now work for us. "You leave Isolt and her maid alone," I said, causing more tears. They were not happy days. It was the time when Isolt learned to speak English, or at least the Northumbrian version of English, for she learned it mostly from me.
"You're my mon,"
she said. I was Mildreth's man, and Isolt's mon. She said she had been born again on the day I came into Peridur's hall.
"I had dreamed of you," she said. "Tall and golden-haired."
"Now you don't dream?" I asked, knowing that her powers of scrying came from dreams.
"I do still dream,"
she said earnestly.
"My brother speaks to me."
"Your brother?" I asked, surprised.
"I was born a twin,"
she told me,
"and my brother came first. And then, as I was born, he died. He went to the shadow world, and he speaks to me of what he sees there."
"What does he see?"
"He sees your king."
"Alfred," I said sourly. "Is that good or bad?"
"I don't know. The dreams are shadowy."
She was no Christian. Instead, she believed that every place and everything had its own god or goddess. A nymph for a stream, a dryad for a wood, a spirit for a tree, a god for the fire and another for the sea. The Christian god, like Thor or Odin, was just one more deity among this unseen throng of powers, and her dreams, she said, were like eavesdropping on the gods. One day, as she rode beside me on the hills above the empty sea, she suddenly said that Alfred would give me power. "He hates me," I told her. "He'll give me nothing."
"He will give you power,"
she said flatly. I stared at her, and she gazed to where the clouds met the waves. Her black hair was unbound, and the sea wind stirred it.
"My brother told me,"
she said.
"Alfred will give you power, and you will take back your northern home, and your woman will be a creature of gold."
"My woman?" She looked at me, and there was sadness in her face.
"There,"
she said.
"Now you know."
And she kicked back her heels and made the horse run along the ridgetop, her hair streaming, her eyes wet with tears. I wanted to know more, but she said she had told me what she had dreamed, and I must be content. At summer's end, we drove the swine into the forest to feed on the fallen beechnuts and acorns. I bought bags of salt, because the killing time was coming, and the meat of our pigs and cattle would have to be salted into barrels to feed us through the winter. Some of that food would come from the men who rented land at the edge of the estate, and I visited them all, so they would know I expected payment of wheat, barley, and livestock. And to show them what would happen if they tried to cheat me, I bought a dozen good swords from a smith in Exoncester. I gave the swords to my men, and in the shortening days we practiced with them. Mildreth might not believe war was coming, but I did not think God had changed Danish hearts. The late autumn brought heavy rain, and the Shire Reeve to Oxton. The Reeve was called Harald, and he was charged with keeping the peace of Devonshire. And he came on horseback, and with him were six other horsemen, all in mail coats and helmets, and all with swords or spears. I waited for him in the hall, making him dismount and come into the smoky shadows. He came cautiously, expecting an ambush. Then his eyes became accustomed to the gloom, and he saw me standing by the central hearth. "You are summoned to the Shire Court," he told me. His men had followed Harold into the hall. "You bring swords into my house?" I asked. Harald looked around the hall, and he saw my men armed with their spears and axes. I'd seen the horsemen approaching and summoned my men, and ordered them to arm themselves. Harald had the reputation of being a decent man, sensible and fair, and he knew how weapons in a hall could lead to slaughter. "You will wait outside," he told his men, and I gestured for my men to put their weapons down. "You are summoned," Harald began again. "I heard you," I said. "There is a debt to be paid," he said, "and a man's death to make good." I said nothing. One of my hounds growled softly, and I put a hand into its fur to silence it. "The court will meet on All Saints' Day," Harald said. "At the cathedral." "I shall be there," I said. He took off his helmet to reveal a balding pate fringed with brown hair. He was at least 10 years older than I, a big man with 2 fingers missing from his shield hand. He limped slightly as he walked towards me. I calmed the hounds, waited. "I was at Sinuet," he said to me, speaking softly. "So was I," I said, "though men pretend I was not." "I know what you did," he said. "So do I." He ignored my surliness. He was showing me sympathy, though I was too proud to show I appreciated it. "The Elder Man has sent men," he warned me, "to take this place once judgment is given." There was a gasp behind me, and I realized Mildreth had come into the hall. Harald bowed to her.
"The hall will be taken?"
Mildreth asked. "If the debt is not paid," Harald said, "the land will be given to the church." He stared up at the newly hewn rafters, as if wondering why I would build a hall on land doomed to be given to God. Mildreth came to stand beside me. She was plainly distressed by Harald's summons, but she made a great effort to compose herself.
"I am sorry," she said, "about your wife."
A flicker of pain crossed Harald's face as he made the sign of the cross. "She was sick a long time, lady. It was merciful of God, I think, to take her. But I'd not known he was a widower, nor did I care much."
"She was a good woman,"
Mildreth said. "She was," Harald said.
"And I pray for her."
"I thank you for that," Harald said.
"As I pray for Odda the Elder,"
Mildreth went on. "God be praised, he lives." Harald made the sign of the cross again. "But he is feeble and in pain." He touched his scalp, showing where Odda the Elder had been wounded. "So who is the judge?" I asked harshly, interrupting the two.
"The bishop," Harald said.
"Not the alderman?"
"He is at Sittenham."
Mildreth insisted on giving Harald and his men ale and food. She and Harald talked a long time, sharing news of neighbours and family. They were both from Devonshire, and I was not, and so I knew few of the folk they talked about. But I pricked up my ears when Harald said that Odda the Younger was marrying a girl from Mercia. "She's in exile here," he said,
"with her family."
"Well born?"
Mildreth asked. "Exceedingly," Harald said.
"I wish them much joy,"
Mildreth said, with evident sincerity. She was happy that day, warmed by Harald's company, though when he had gone she chided me for being churlish.
"Harald is a good man,"
she insisted.
"A kind man. He would have given you advice. He would have helped you."
I ignored her. But 2 days later I went into Exoncester with Isolde and all my men. Including Hasten, I now had 18 warriors, and I had armed them, given them shields and leather coats, and I led them through the market that always accompanied the court sittings. There were stilt walkers and jugglers, a man who ate fire, and a dancing bear. There were singers, harpists, storytellers, beggars, and pens of sheep, goats, cattle, pigs, geese, ducks, and hens. There were fine cheeses, smoked fish,
bladders of lard, pots of honey, trays of apples and baskets of pears. Isolde, who had not been to Exoncester before, was amazed at the size of the city, and the life of it, and the seething closeness of its houses, and I saw folk make the sign of the cross when they saw her, for they had heard of the Shadow Queen held at Oxton, and they knew her for a foreigner and a pagan. Beggars crowded at the bishop's gate. There was a crippled woman with a blind child, men who had lost arms or legs in the wars, a score of them, and I threw them some pence. Then, because I was on horseback, ducked under the archway of the courtyard beside the cathedral, where a dozen chained felons were awaiting their fate. A group of young monks, nervous of the chained men, were plaiting beehives, while a score of armed men were clustered around three fires. They eyed my followers suspiciously, as a young priest, his hands flapping, hurried across the puddles.
"Weapons are not to be brought into the precinct," he told me sternly.
"Well, they've got weapons." I nodded at the men warming themselves by the flames.
"They are the Reeves men."
"And then the sooner you deal with my business," I said, "the sooner my weapons will be gone." He looked up at me, his face anxious.
"Your business?"
"Is with the bishop."
"Well, the bishop is at prayer,"
the priest said reprovingly, as though I should have known that.
"And he cannot see every man who comes here. You can talk to me."
I smiled and raised my voice a little. "In Sippenham, 2 years ago," I said, "your bishop was friends with Ainflaed. She has red hair and works her trade out of the Corncrake Tavern. Her trade is whoring." The priest's hands were flapping again in an attempt to persuade me to lower my voice. "I've been with Ainflaed," I said, "and she told me about the bishop. She said..." The monks had stopped making beehives and were listening, but the priest cut me off by half-shouting,
The bishop might have a moment free."
"And then tell him I'm here," I said pleasantly.
"You are Uhtred of Oxton?"
he asked. "No," I said. "I am the Lord Uhtred of Bebbanburg."
"Yes, Lord."
"Sometimes known as Uhtredewa," I added mischievously. "Uhtred the Wicked."
"Yes, Lord,"
the priest said again, and hurried away. The bishop was called Aylward, and he was really the bishop of Cridianton, but that place had not been thought as safe as Exoncester, and so for years the bishops of Cridianton had lived in the larger town, which, as Guthrum had shown, was not the wisest decision. Guthrum's Danes had pillaged the cathedral and the bishop's house, which was still scantily furnished, and I discovered Aylward sitting behind a table that looked as if it had once belonged to a butcher, for its hefty top was scored with knife cuts and stained with old blood. He looked at me indignantly. "You should not be here," he said.
"Why not?"
"You have business before the court tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?"
I said. "You sit as a judge. Today you are a bishop." He acknowledged that with a small nod. He was an elderly man with a heavy, jowled face and a reputation as a severe judge. He had been with Alfred in Sheerburnen when the Danes arrived in Exoncester, which is why he was still alive. And, like all the bishops in Wessex, he was a fervent supporter of the king, and I had no doubt that Alfred's dislike of me was known to Aylward, which meant I could expect little clemency when the court sat. "I am busy," Aylward said, gesturing at the parchments on the stained table. Two clerks shared the table, and a half-dozen resentful priests had gathered behind the bishop's chair. "My wife," I said, "inherited a debt to the church." Aylward looked at Isolde, who alone had come into the house with me. She looked beautiful, proud and wealthy. There was silver at her throat and in her hair, and her cloak was fastened with two brooches, one of jet and the other of amber.
"Your wife?" the bishop asked snidely.
"I would discharge the debt," I said, ignoring his question, and I tipped a bag onto his butcher's table,
and the big silver plates we had taken from Ivar slid out. The silver made a satisfying noise as it thumped down, and suddenly, in that small dark room, ill-lit by three rush lights,